Welcome, everybody. My name's Joe. I am addicted to alcohol and other substances and a proud member of AA. Welcome, everybody. This is the International Conference of Secular AA International. What are we calling it now, Megan? The
Global Story Time.
Story Time, yes. Trying to make it more playful. If you're new to us, the International Conference of Secular AA is something that happens in person every 2 years. Started in Santa Monica in 2014. We were looking forward to being in Washington, D.C. In 2020, and we postponed a year because we knew things. Oh, yeah, 2021, everything will be done. There'll be no more COVID. No one will be talking about it. Absolutely. There is an old Middle Eastern expression, man makes plans and Allah laughs. And I suppose we had a little bit of that when the shit hit the fan again. So we are, again, optimistically planning an October 28th to 30th in-person Washington, D.C. conference in Bethesda, Washington. There will be some online component and some in-person component, COVID willing. So we'll just see. I'm going to post details for that in the chat. Please help yourself. It's my great pleasure. I'm going to turn the meeting over to Deborah, who's assembled our crew. It came from Hollywood, all about finding our muse in recovery. Will there be creativity sober? We'll find out. Okay, where are you, Deborah?
I'm right here, somewhere okay. On your screen. Hi, my name is Deborah. I am a person who learned the hard way that if I pour alcohol on my problems, I can create a hell of a conflagration that's hard to put out. When I made LA home some 40 years ago, I certainly was aware that, you know, Hollywood and the music biz were here. And I know there's creativity everywhere, but a lot of our economy is based on it. So I decided when I was asked to do this that we would hear some people who spend their lives being creative. And I'm just going to introduce them by name. They will take it from there. We have three speakers, and I'm going to try to leave 15 or 20 minutes at the end for shares. All right. So first we have Megan P.
Thank you. I was like, I'm
there
muted.
She is.
Okay. Hi, I'm Megan. I'm an alcoholic who so happens to be an atheist, and I'm 13 today.
Hi, Megan.
Hello. Now, Deborah, are you going to introduce everyone?
This is Megan P. This is her 13th birthday. I have actually never heard her share, but I know a little bit about what she's about, and I think you're going to love her.
Okay. So I guess it's me going straight on in. Alrighty. Yes. So once again, I'm Megan. I'm an alcoholic, most definitely an alcoholic. I got off a flight not too long ago. I cried all night because of family dysfunction, but I'm still sober 13 years. And I misplaced my AA 12 and 12. I am the type of atheist alcoholic who has read all the books pretty much and followed the steps. I sometimes go to regular meetings, especially when they were in person. But the AA 12 and 12 has pretty much how I live my life in the foreword, because I even read the forewords and introductions and all of that, because I'm that sort of person. AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. I wanted to do that to just start one of my most favorite speakers when I was new in AA. She'd always start her speech and say, I'm happily and usefully whole. And I said, where'd you get that from? And I hadn't got to the AA 12 and 12 yet. And when I get such a long time to speak, especially about what I do outside of meetings or just outside of being a person, or how I make my money, Because yes, I do make my money from creating kind of terrible movies. You know, I make movies of the week now. I wouldn't be able to do it without program. Rewind a little bit just so you can know who I am. I'm from the Midwest. I'm from Ohio. I grew up with a mother that didn't want to have me, a dad who wanted to have me, but didn't know how to be a parent. They were married. I have a brother, younger brother. Around the age of 13, I needed to start getting out of myself from some sexual abuse and not feeling comfortable in my body because I have a reproductive system that is coming to kill me. So around 13, around 15, you know, bulimia didn't work anymore. So I took it up a notch to start drinking, and I was a drinker. It really worked. It stopped me from feeling all the hormonal fluctuations. It stopped me, you know, start me being comfortable in my body. I just so happened to be smart, and I understood literature. I understood the power of poems, but I also was kind of nerdy too in like math and science. So I did really well in the inner city of Columbus, Ohio. I went off to Mount Holyoke. It's a women's school. It was the first seminary where women can get education. So they're really big on making women literate. And while I was there, I was like a politics and education major at first. And then I realized real power comes from theater, films, TV. But I also kept drinking. The reproductive problems were just mounting. And coming from two people who had high levels of depression and anxiety, both of them, my parents, I was just basically numbing every emotion that I could get. And I, senior year, didn't fulfill my film school applications and continued to drink. I went to Boston after college, and I ended up being a stage management intern at American Repertory Theater. And that was the beginning of my professional career in this business. But it was muted. Instead of hanging out with actors, getting to know directors, I knew all the bartenders in Cambridge, all of them. I moved to New York and I became friends with Tariq. He was the bartender at Junior's Cheesecake in Brooklyn. And that's who I knew. The other opportunities that I have, I just didn't take advantage of them. So I left New York, went back home to Ohio because I had my second nervous breakdown, which is very interesting because I thought alcohol was helping me deal with my issues. I did have a close support system that never really let me do a lot of drugs because of my depression. And that woman, we're still friends today. That the one who was the main one. My friends also, when I was at American Repertory Theater, they gave me an intervention. I didn't remember it until I got sober. That's how much I was drinking. When I came back to Ohio, had the nervous breakdown, I went into, and I was in Akron, Ohio, the founding place of this fellowship. The head psychiatrist was like, she's too high functioning. So she's not an alcoholic. So that kind of gave me recourse to keep drinking for a few more years. And all in this time, I had done a few plays, like four or five plays at Cleveland Playhouse. You know, still trying to keep it alive. I applied to grad school twice for film. I don't think I made any, but that all kind of died out, you know. And then something hit me when I was in Ohio. I said, I need to leave here. I'm really going to kill myself by the time I'm 30. I don't know if I want to. And so I said, well, my friends in New York are moving to LA. Let me just go. And I went. And my particular family that I saw that made it a crazy night last night for me, they decided to retire in Phoenix. And I said, Mom, you need somebody to drive your car cross country. I said, put my car on your trailer and then I'll drive across country. I drove across country drunk, but I made it. And because I never drove sober, actually. I didn't realize that until I got sober, that champagne is alcohol. I thought champagne, you know, like now is like sparkling water. That's the type of alcoholic I was. My neck was double the size of what it was. I was just that bloated with alcohol. I guess I should maybe show a before and after picture one time, just so people can actually see. I had the Fred Flintstone going on. Got to LA, called two of my alums from Mount Holyoke. Thank you for the 15. Called two of my Mount Holyoke alums. And because we can do that, that very elite school, they set me up. And I got so desperate with my drinking. I said, well, before I die, let's really try to make a real movie. One of those alums got me on a film set as a PA. I have that picture in my bedroom when I walk in, because one of the mothers, I was the child wrangler. It was a children's horror movie. And so all the children, when they were with the studio teacher, I'd walk them back and forth to set and stuff like that. And I was the most happy of my life. I was like, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do. This is chaos. It's so much chaos. Everybody is like trying to tell the director what the director doesn't want to do. Like, it was just, and I was like, there's all these people. It's like, I just didn't realize it was that many people in person. And I was like, my department production was the one who put it in line, you know, helped the director get things across, even when the crew was going anti their mission for whatever reason. And it still happens. That picture, that woman said, nobody else is happy here on set today, but you are the most happy. You found your happy place. Basically, from that moment, I said, I got to learn how to live to be able to do this. One of my girlfriends from Mount Holyoke, she started Overeaters Anonymous. She told me about the program and she said, I think it'll help you. What I found in that program is I couldn't listen to anything because my bourbon addiction was so huge. I was going to bourbon. I was drinking bourbon so much. I had to go to different liquor stores because the men who worked there wouldn't serve me, like wouldn't let me buy it because they said a woman shouldn't drink so much. Now that's sexist, whatever, but it stuck in my head. I was like, do I drink too much? Like it was one of those things where I was like, I have to go different places to drink. And the whole time towards the end of my drinking, my anxiety was to get so bad that I could not quiet down the fact that I should make stories. I should be helping people make stories. So I was on the fringes. I was doing reality TV and things like that. But I was like, I have stories to tell. I have stories to tell. So I got sober and had to deal with about 5 years of really bad wreckage. I was very suicidal and, you know, just dealing with all the feelings that I had packed down for about a good 15 so years. I was on a reality show, the show Naked and Afraid. And the Black Lives Matter movement had happened. And when I came back, because I was in the untouched rainforest where I knew Ferguson had happened because it happened before I left. But when I got back, I had no idea. It was like this big mass movement. And I think that was like 2016, I think. And I said, I got to make a film about this, you know, because I have many emotions and I have to make a film. So I made my first short film, used a person from my atheist home group at the time and put him in it. And yeah, that was the beginning of the journey for me to deal with the anger, with me to deal with the, what I think is the solution to the problem in a healthy way. I made my first film. I also made two other films. I produced other people's films. Those other two films that I produced did way better than my particular film because I'm a natural producer. I'm a natural organizer of chaos, organizer of different people getting along. And I think that I learned how to do that, one, by stepping out of the way, which I learned in program. The other thing is I have a strong passion to tell a true story. You know, once I read the story to be able to tell it. So fast forward to today, I'm a network executive that oversees the physical production of Movies a Week for cable network. But I get to work with very famous people. And very famous people have a lot of issues, whether they're one of us or not. And because of the principles of this program, I get to tell them, you're being a horse's ass in a nice way. I get to tell them, no, you can't do this. It costs so much money. Maybe we should stop a day. We could cut out a day of production if you want to do that. And then they think, they're like, cut out a whole day of production? Oh, well, I won't do that. And it makes me happy. Even in the craziness of the world, even though some of our movies are not the most top quality, I love it. And I just started my own production company. And I'm meeting with one of my partners and just creativity around. And we're going to get together a group of about 8 different women who want to make projects. And we're going to support each other this year to get those off the ground. I'm very, very excited. My compliance department at work, because I do follow the rules. I told them what I'm up to, the festivals that I've been in. I just had a doc that was in the festival circuit. And I told them, you know, this is what I do, but I don't create your IP. Can I continue to do creative work outside of my job? They said, yes. So the whole Paramount umbrella blessed me. And that's just because I decided to be straight up. I learned that from program. It makes me very, very happy. So even though I might make, you know, a crazy hip hop Christmas movie or crazy country movie, I enjoy that people get to zone out, which we all need, especially us who do not partake in stimulants, except coffee, which I'm about to have, which is right next to my computer. I'm about to have while I listen to everyone else. I'm glad I get to make that content. Even the reality TV that I made, I'm glad I get to. People take a break out of this crazy, crazy world. And all I have to say is, when I have to deal with setting healthy boundaries with my family, which I'm going to have to work on with my sponsor and outside help, going to work every day and helping to craft stories, also helping to employ people that have never been union before to become union and hopefully retire, it does make me happily and useful whole. You know, it really, really, really makes me, it makes me level in the way I thought alcohol did. You know, I still have my hormonal problems. I still have a lot of the same fears and things that I had around filmmaking and my voice, but I just show up now and I just do it, and it's and it's not perfect. You know, I just use all of the 12 steps and a lot of the traditions in my day-to-day life. I am a long haul COVID sufferer, and I'm thinking about shaping this experimental film around what is mild. I think losing 2 senses is not mild. And I don't exactly know how I'm going to do it, but it's something that I've started writing on so that I can deal with the fact that I've become disabled because of COVID. And that is a project that I'm going to work on outside of work. I'm also going to do another Black Lives Matter-esque movie, which is going to just help me deal with a lot of the politics around race and also privilege. And that's very helpful. Another thing that I'm working on too is because I want to do a 3-part short series about just how my life was affected during COVID. So it's a personal story about me, like how the long Los Angeles lockdown affected me. And then the other one is going to be a narrative about a love relationship I had with a man. We basically had, we were friends with benefits for the whole shelter in place lockdown, and how that's a positive thing. It's not a bad thing. because in society, it's like, if you're not married, if you're not working to love, it's like, what is this? What is this for a woman? It actually was a great thing for me. You know, I was healthy. I was honest. Everything in the program, in this relationship, and really neither one of us ended with bad feelings. If I called him, he'd call me back. If he called me, I'd call him back today. And I'm very, you know, and so anyway, so that's where I am creatively today. Still sober, still want to be sober. Yeah, I really don't have anything else, but thank all of you for showing up. Want to hear the other two speakers. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you, Megan. What a journey from creating wreckage to creating all kinds of positive things. You have to tell me where I can find your work. And happy 13th birthday. I'm next going to ask Sri to join us. I have heard Sri share before. One of the things I've noticed in local AA meetings is how many guitars I see in people's backgrounds. And I think that if we're in secular AA, we have to be more creative because we aren't given a set of dogmatic rules to follow. We have to figure it out for ourselves. And that's the kind of creativity that everybody in secular AA has to find. But Sri's involves a guitar. And so Sri, take it away.
Thanks, Deborah. That makes perfect sense. You unmuted me and I muted myself. That's it, folks. Thanks so much for asking me to speak here. And thank you so much for your share, Megan, and congratulations on 13 years. That's awesome. Yeah, it was, I'm weirdly nervous. Usually I gab a lot. I don't have difficulty talking. I'm really nervous because I have a lot to say and it usually comes out all jumbled up. So, you know, let me start, give you a little bit of my old story. I was not born and raised in the U.S. I was born and raised in India. And, in India, the Brits left us English, right? And somehow I became an Anglophile. I was always interested in literature and music from over here. But before all that, you know, I come from a very, very dysfunctional family. I was taken away from my mom, kind of kidnapped when I was younger, taken away to my father's side of the family. My dad's never been in my life. I was raised by my grandparents. There's all these stories of that I keep hearing. And I used to think my story was very unique before. And I kept hearing stories of other people. And I was like, okay, maybe I'm not the only person who's gone through that. In the beginning, that used to piss me off. Now it doesn't. Now it feels like, okay, well, that means that if this person has gone through this kind of a life and managed to have a happy, creative, sober, successful life, maybe I have a chance. You know, before it was, I was always stuck in my own tragedy. My entire life, I saw myself as a tragic person. I expected something terrible to happen. I was the only child. I was, you know, there's no one was around really. And I just grew up with music and comic books and art. And I was just a nerdy little kid. I was quiet. I didn't really have too many friends because talk about resentments. When you're a kid, kids can be assholes, right? Because I have weird eyes. And that instantly became this thing for me. Like everybody was like, this guy, kind of thing. So from the very beginning, I decided I needed to do something to, you know, somewhere along the line, I wanted to be the center of attention. So the way I learned to be the center of attention was trying to be really good at what someone else was good at. You know, it was so pathological that I would actually go and I would change my handwriting every couple of months because I would see someone else. I was like, that looks better. So I'm going to be this person now. I'm going to write differently as a kid. And eventually I was so happy because my teacher she actually took my book and she showed it around the class when I was a kid. Like, this is how a clean handwriting should look. And I was like so happy about it, but all the kids hated me, you know? So then I kind of had this constant state of, I would describe my childhood as like constant chaos and confusion. The parents, people were always yelling. We were in the loudest house on the street. And I grew up around chaos and I assumed that's what normal is. You know, I assumed it's normal to keep yelling, throwing things and not feel safe. And somehow in that group of, misfits, I was the quieter one, which is saying something. You know, I was the calm one. You know, I assumed the role of Switzerland at a young age. I was always like, okay, everybody calm down, you know, that kind of thing. And I just felt like I could do that. It was my job to make sure everybody is happy and everybody is calm. And if you weren't, it was on me. So the way I started doing that is through humor. And somehow I figured out people would, you know, laugh at my jokes and or laugh at me. Either way, it did not matter. You know, I got to humor. And then I kind of made friends that way. So my identity then became this guy. I was like this guy with this really nice handwriting was also kind of funny at times, you know. And then I've always loved music. You know, I started listening to things where as I started getting my teenagers, I started hearing things that really started to appeal to me. You know, growing up in a conservative family in the southern part of India, when you listen to Dyer's Eve by Metallica for the first time, you know, I'm like, that makes sense. I'm angry and he's speaking to me. You know, I'm like, this makes a lot of sense. Then I went into that mode. For a while, I wanted to please everybody. And then I switched to the other side where I'm like, fuck everybody. I don't give a shit. I am me. And this is going to be my rebellious face. You know, so I went through my, it's funny looking back, but that's what I did. I went through my rebellious phase where I was like, everything I ever saw was, you know, not true. I was obsessed with the truth. And, you know, everybody was a hypocrite. You know, but I wasn't. I never saw myself as a hypocrite. Of course not. I was not a hypocrite. I was, you know, I was honest and I knew what was correct and I knew what the right thing was to do at all times. I didn't truly believe that, but I certainly acted like it. So, you know, I got into music. I started playing guitar. And but the thing that I really, you know, that helped me when I got sober, helped me get sober as well is one of the things the guitar did for me is, you know, I started learning the guitar because I really wanted to make music. And something weird started happening, you know, and my grandparents tried to make me learn the violin and I hated it, but I wanted to learn the guitar. And something weird started happening where, you know, I wanted to, you know, play really complicated stuff and impress people. But before that happened, there were times where I would be sitting with my guitar with myself, you know, an hour would feel like a minute, you know, or, you know, it would feel like, what just happened? I don't remember what I was doing. I was just there. And that's the closest I can ever come to describing what transcendence feels like to me. It sounds like a big word. And because I wasn't thinking of myself, I was just sitting there. I was just practicing. I was just playing guitar and I loved it. And I always had it with me. I always played guitar all the time, you know, and I went to college for engineering. You know, there's no real career in music in India. And I'm still not a professional musician. I'd like to talk like I'm one. I ended up getting into engineering. And, you know, life threw a lot of weird curveballs at me. I had all these plans. You know, I was going to do this in music. I was going to do that. And I literally had the, you know, the almost the Indian version of a country song happen to me, right? So we lost everything. Lost, you know, I was homeless in India. I was going to come here for my grad school and I couldn't afford to. I worked in a call center, and here's a little joke for you. I was actually Neil McKenzie at Dell in 2001. If you called and cussed me out, dude, you owe me an amends. So I was Neil McKenzie at Dell at some point. You know, things got more and more tragic in my mind. I started feeling like life was just one obstacle after another. My girlfriend left me. I had to sell my guitar for money. I had nothing, basically nothing, you know. And then I eventually made it out here. I went to school in the South. I went to LSU first, and then I graduated from University of Florida. I came here for grad school for engineering. But throughout, like the one constant in my life was, you know, the songs that I used to love. And I could always just drift away in my head into the songs I loved, you know. And that's something that I really want to, you know, come back to is how the same song feels different when, you know, depending on when I heard it. You know, when I heard it when I was 12, when I heard it when I was 17, and how it feels today, it's very interesting because it tells me a lot about me as a person and how I've changed. So I came over here and, you know, and all this time, the drinking, I should go back, pedal back a little bit. All my idols were drunk, dead, miserable musicians, writers, actors, all the absolute most miserable. And I grew up in the 90s. I was supposed to be miserable. You know, everything was miserable and I was very fashionably miserable, you know. And then the people I idolized were all like, you know, these intense people who were always like drinking and, you know, and I started, you know, literature, everyone I looked up to was a drunk. And I kind of, but still I had a healthy fear of, you know, I had this obsession with absolutes where I thought that it's not right and I'm not going to do it. My friends started drinking before me and I thought that I'm better than them, so I'm not going to drink. So they all started drinking and I was a judgmental asshole. But if, and I had my first drink at 19 and cut to, you know, 22 years later, I'm in AA and they're all normies, you know, and which is cool. But, you know, I loved the feeling I got because all those things where I was trying to be somebody else just vanished. I felt like this is who I really am. Because once I had my first buzz, I was like, this is who I really am. I'm not the guy who cares about, like, you know, I don't care about my handwriting anymore. I don't want to impress anybody with anything, but this is who I really am. This feels so comfortable. I'm not worried about what anyone is thinking about me. I don't need to be the center of attention. Something about it just was magical. And, you know, but it still didn't I didn't latch onto it alcoholically at the very beginning. But when I did drink, I loved to binge. So after I came out here, I still kept playing the guitar. I had sold my guitar in India. But fortunately, along the way, I made really good friends. And I had a friend who sent me one of his old Squire Strats from San Diego. He shipped it to Baton Rouge, where I used to live. And it was so nice. Like, they all remembered me as the guy. They were like, Shreez, you know, you're going through hell. Just remember to play your guitar, is what they would say to me, which is so sweet of them. That guy's still a friend. And, you know, all these things went on and on. But I should have mentioned the part which I assumed was normal, was that whole fashionably miserable part of it was one thing, but I've always been clinically depressed. I was taken to a therapist when I was 6. I was taken to a therapist when, you know, from that age onwards. I was given Prozac when I was 11. I was 100% convinced that I was dying all the time. And that whole mentality of I'm a tragic person and something bad is going to happen and you'll all remember me someday and you'll all feel bad was what my head was telling me all the time. And this depression did not go away. There were phases in life where I was confused and I had all these plans. And when things did not work out the way that I wanted them to work out, it just reaffirmed my belief that, you know, everything was going to be really hard and difficult for me and that there's no point. I'm just this, you know, mess. It wasn't until I moved out here that I started having insane panic attacks. And once I started having intense panic attacks, I was diagnosed with, you know, this anxiety disorder and severe depression, and I was given medication. But one thing that doesn't, that, you know, psychiatrists told all of us that never sunk in is that these medicines don't work with alcohol. So I chose the alcohol instead. So my life for a very long time became, after graduating and working as an engineer, it just became all about drinking at night and Xanax during the day. You know, I had all these plans of I was going to write this, I was going to do that, I was going to make this, I was going to... Nothing really materialized. I had bits and pieces of output here and there, but nothing really materialized because after a while, my drinking got so heavy that when life didn't go my way and I didn't deal with my, you know, the things that were troubling me, that I stopped playing guitar for many years. And it would just lie there, or I sold off whatever I had to buy booze. And when I was going through all this, you know, there were times where, you know, I would have these momentary low bottoms, and I had friends who were worried about me, and they asked me to go to AA. And then I went to AA for the first time in Florida, and I walked in, and it was weird. There was a bunch of people just sitting there talking about their feelings. I just stayed there for a whole hour because I'm polite. Then I left and went straight to Tim and Terry's and got messed up. Somehow, I really refused to take the hand of AA when help was offered to me. And later on, I realized it's kind of like, you know, I'm drowning. And I'm in the middle of the ocean. And there's this boat that goes by and they're all offering me help, but I don't want to take their help because they're playing shitty music on the boat. You know, that's what I got. I feel like I was doing, you know, like I would rather die. No, I mean, their belief system bothered me so much And then I had to ask myself, why is it that their belief system bothers me? Because in reality, when I was out drinking in bars in the deep South, I didn't give a shit about anybody's belief system at the bar. Everyone was drinking with me. You know, somehow I have a problem with someone else's belief system when it comes to getting sober. So I had to catch myself on that. And now I know, and I tell myself every day, that a belief system did not get me sober, does not keep me sober, but it can very quickly get me drunk, because I can believe a lot of stuff that's not true. But I think I'm kind of meandering all over the place, so bear with me. But what I do really want to say is, you know, the depression and, you know, the romanticizing that I used to do with alcoholism and with writing and, you know, trying to look at other writers who were drunks, and I tried to emulate the wrong things from other people in history who were drunks and who were successful in creative endeavors. I don't romanticize that life anymore. You know, life has suffering. You know, there is suffering in everybody's life. You know, I don't have to worship needless suffering. I don't have to cause needless suffering. There is suffering. There's no honor to me in needless suffering. You know, needless suffering is what I inflict upon myself. Suffering that comes, that happens as a part of life is something that we all go through. You know, and it's also made me question my motivation behind, you know, trying to write music or write literature. It's like, why am I doing this? Is it for attention? Is it for fame? Is it for money? But fundamentally, what sobriety and working the steps has done for me is, the whole point for me is to share what I went through, so no one, someone else reading this, you know, or hearing it would not feel so alone. And that's it. And there's the whole point of, I heard someone say in a meeting that if you have the gift of creativity, then you give back by creating. You know, and that's something that I've written down on my desk as well, because there is no, how do I put this? I truly believe that none of the so-called great musicians, writers, etc., had this magnum opus come out of nowhere. There's a lot of work that goes into it. There's a lot of failures that happened, you know, before people got to that point of success. And the same way for my sobriety, I failed miserably. I took almost 90 days worth of 24-hour chips before I got the 3 years and 4 months that I have today. But the key is, relapse is also a part of my story. It's a part of many of us' stories. It doesn't mean that it's the end of the world. It just means that, you know, we just get up and try again. And just like anything else, just like music, just like art, anything, I get what I put into sobriety. You know, the more I practice trying to be emotionally sober, the easier it gets. Each time I don't pick up a drink when I want to pick up a drink, it gets easier the next time around. I mean, I used to need to drink to open the mail because I couldn't handle the anxiety, right? I don't do that anymore. It's ridiculous looking back, but I really needed it. And as far as this mindset of being, you know, exceptionally tragic as a person, I have to let it go. I do want to say that nothing bothers me as much as cynicism these days. So I'm about to have my first kid at 42. So, and you know, both my wife and I are going to be older parents. And when this started happening, as I started getting sober, we were thinking of having kids. And I was like, what's the one thing I need to do? It's like, you know, I need to really look at my worldview. And if I am so cynical, it's not fair to bring another person into this world. And I really, truly believe that. And every day for me is a fight against cynicism, my own. And I try my hardest to not perpetuate misery. And I don't worship misery like I used to. And I don't worship needless suffering. And, you know, I also have learned here, just like many of us have with, you know, I was never judged in AA. That was the one thing that really blew my mind. You know, I kept relapsing. I would come back and I hated myself. I was full of guilt and shame. I would sit in a meeting and for 1 hour, nobody judged me when I relapsed. And two, I was not able to judge myself for 1 hour. That was magical. I was not able to think of myself for bits and pieces in that 1 hour to start with. I was not able to judge myself. So I also realized that, you know, just like sobriety, art is personal. So I try not to judge other people. And creativity is personal. And everyone's on their own path. The next thing I wanted to say is that, you know, I tried to not believe in absolutes. You know, because, you know, there when as someone who's always used to black and white thinking, the only absolute I have is I do not pick up a drink, no matter what. Everything else, you know, can be, there are gray areas in everything. So there's no such thing as the perfect song ever written, or the perfect comic bit, or the perfect novel. You know, I think the reality is that the one thing I am is imperfect, and the one thing I want to be is perfect, and I'll never be perfect. The biggest release I've gotten out of this program is being okay with being imperfect. And life is a mess for everyone around me. Looking around, I don't see anyone else's life as perfect. Everybody's a mess, you know? And what we do is we all get together and laugh about it. And, you know, sometimes we have to cry about it, and that's okay too. Finally, I do want to say is, I used to say this all the time, right? I don't want to be, you know, I used to go to meetings and look at people, and like, you know, all these religious people. I'm like, you know, what a bunch of hypocrites. And I always think, if you're religious, you're automatically a hypocrite in my book, used to be. And then I was like, I would rather be a drunk than be a hypocrite. The problem is I was both a drunk and a hypocrite, you know? So I wasn't really doing anything right there. And AA is somewhere where I really started to question my own honesty in behind the things I do. And AA is where honesty was awarded. It was actually rewarded with cookies and coffee. You know, when I was a kid, if I was honest, I was punished. And each time I came to a meeting and was honest about how I was feeling, honest about a relapse, I was actually rewarded with hugs and cookies and coffee, which is awesome. So all these things slowly changed my mind, my mindset, to a point where I, you know, I try very hard on a daily basis to practice the principles. And the most important thing that I have realized for myself is I have to pass it on. If I can do or say anything that makes another person want to live, smile, anything at all, then I've done something good that day. Believing all the right things and not taking any action to help another person is useless for me. You know, I can believe all the right things, but I never helped anybody to do anything. Doesn't mean anything. Me believing in, I'm not able to sit in my own, bask in my own glory. It's exhausting. I have learned the importance of picking up my phone and checking on other people. You know, they don't have to be people in AA. They can be just friends, just to ask them how their day is going. My mantra when I'm listening to anyone, including my wife, is, it's not about you, it's not about you, it's not about you. I keep repeating that to myself all the time. It's a much better way of living. It's nice to remember what I played at a show. It's nice to not be obsessed with, you know, how much money do I have left? You know, how many shows? I remember once where I'd cracked a rib before a show. And apparently when I was on stage, I don't remember anything. Each time I spoke, I increased the count of Jaeger bombs that I had by like two. Everything, excuse me, guys, I've had like 14. And they're like, wait, you just said 12. You just said 10. I don't have to live like an insane, you know, in desperation anymore. And finally, I learned from some really good musicians that I play what I like to play now. I'm not playing to impress anybody. It's finally I'm able to sit down with my guitar and occasionally feel that transcendence, because it's just me sitting with my guitar. I'm not trying to impress my wife. She will not be impressed. You know, I am not trying to impress anybody. And the reality is that there is no amount of adoration, love, money, fame, alcohol, Xanax, pizza, anything I can think of, that's enough for me. I'll always want more. So I'm okay. I've made peace with that void. So I can try to move on with my life and spend more time creating and less time talking. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sri. That was fantastic. Next time I'm griping about someone else's belief system, I'm going to keep in mind how much that mattered to me when I was drinking. It's a great insight. So for our final contestant here on Hollywood Squares, this morning, afternoon, or evening, depending where you are, I would like to ask Kathleen F. to join us. Another person I know, but had no idea what she did. And I'm looking to hear from her how her journey in alcoholism and her creative life, where that intersection is. So Kathleen, I can't see you on my screen, but I know you're here, and take it away.
Thank you so much, Deborah, for asking me to speak. My name is Kathleen and I'm an alcoholic. Happy birthday to Megan, 13 years. Can't wait to celebrate with you. And thanks so much for your lead and for you as well, Sri. You just disappeared from my screen. But anyway, I think this topic is incredible. No matter if you have a career in the creative realm or you don't, I think creativity is essential to living a joyful and pleasurable life. And that can look many different ways, but I'll let you know about mine. I grew up in the Midwest too, was born into a very Irish Catholic family who was very into sports. And I didn't feel like I fit in. But the good thing is that my mother started me in dance classes when I was, I think, three. Started with, you know, a little baby ballet. And then I eventually also took tap dancing and jazz. And that was just a beautiful form of expression for me and taught me that movement and physical expression was just essential for my mental health too, even though I didn't maybe know it at, you know, a young age. Dance was something that I did regularly from the age of three until the age of 18. You know, I was a very shy girl, and that kind of allowed me to practice getting confident in myself and taught me that, you know, with practice and preparedness, you know, I could face my fears of, let's say, dancing on a stage in front of a crowd of people. So I eventually started doing some acting and stage acting and singing, which also were just different facets of that creative expression, physical creative expression that really just made my heart sing. And I also was an avid journaler from, I think, the age of third grade, and something that I've mostly kept up with my entire life. And I realized that words really helped me process things that were going on in my life. Like a lot of us, I am clinically depressed and have been in therapy and or on medications most of my life, except when, yeah, I thought alcohol and drugs were doing that for me. But yeah, words kind of helped me work through things. Words also helped me express myself in a different way. And as I got into high school, I had some pretty fucked up idols too. You know, a lot of the beat poets and a lot of white men, Charles Bukowski, Tom Wolfe, Hunter S. Thompson. And I just thought like, oh, wow, like how creative, you know, you can just like live and drink and, I don't know, just live a little dangerously and, you know, get by. I thought I was going to be a poet. That's what I wanted to do. And I took a creative writing class in high school. I was already drinking at the time, but it wasn't, well, I've always been a problem drinker because I've always been a drinker that once I start, I can't stop. But, you know, I had started when I was 15. So still in high school, it was like somewhat manageable, I guess, just because I didn't really have access to it very often. So I was drinking, but I also found a little substance called Adderall, which was prescribed to a lot of girls in my class. And I found that Adderall really took me to a place where I thought like I was connecting with this creative muse or whatever. I thought it brought out things in myself that I could only get from this substance. And I thought it was so cool. And I wrote a series of poems, all high, of course, that got me a small creative writing scholarship to college. And so I was like on my way, you know, using creativity and, you know, drug enhanced to kind of like take that next step in my life. And I got to college and no parent supervision. I remember showing up to school with nothing in my backpack except a bottle of vodka. And I got really good at, you know, this is probably too much information, but I got really good at like holding a bottle between my thighs and like wearing like a dress or a skirt and kind of waltzing in and like not getting back checked. I continued with the creative writing and the literature and the English classes. And that was something that I just thrived in. But you know, I was drinking constantly, and the Adderall also helped me kind of get through the hangovers and push through that. I was also smoking a lot of weed to come down from the hangovers. So it was just this sort of like circle of chemical dependence that I didn't really acknowledge was an issue yet. And my parents were eventually like, oh, okay, so you want to write poetry, you want to write books. So, you know, how are you going to support yourself? Are you going to become a teacher? And I was like, no, I'm not going to become a teacher. No offense to any teachers in the room, but for me, I was just too young and I didn't feel like I had enough world experience to be able to share it with other people. So I quickly pivoted to studying journalism, which I loved it especially because like I didn't know what I want to do with my life. I still don't really know what I want to do with my life, but journalism allowed me to talk to other people to figure out what, you know, maybe what I could do. I fell into that. It was a good compromise, from, you know, writing creatively and also writing in a way that is a little bit more marketable. At least it was then. That's a whole other story about how it is now. I eventually left college and I got a very insane 3-month internship to go work in Doha, Qatar, for a lifestyle magazine. So I had this 3-month internship and then I stayed for a year in Doha as a 21-year-old. And that kind of flipped everything I knew about the world on its head. In the best of ways. It was also like a huge reality check to the privilege that I had, from, you know, being an American, being a white woman, in a world that was very unfair, where there is active indentured servitude and, all kinds of issues, that I just really hadn't experienced being a kid from Nebraska. It quickly gave me some amazing perspective. After that experience, a lot of weird stuff happened, and that's a whole other story. But I would also say too that it was really difficult there. My team and I were working for a Qatari emir. He had to sponsor our visas so we could work in the country. That also required us to go to long dinners with him and his friends a couple of nights a week. And, he also didn't understand that, you couldn't like plagiarize images and print them. You couldn't like, he wanted us to print press releases for his friends' businesses. And we also we're struggling with him, you know, to tell him that that's not really how journalism works. But anyway, we made 12 good issues, that I think we're all pretty proud of. But by that point, things were getting very strange and it was becoming unsustainable working for this man. And so we all left. And after that experience, I felt like I could do anything. And I still remember that when I'm going through something hard, it's just like, okay, well, if I can get through that, like I can get through this. But I moved to New York. I got an internship with a media company and I was writing for their website about creativity, art, and how technology enhances art. And it was the perfect fit because I love the arts. And so this particular company that I worked for was known for even its top leaders being complete wrecks and sex, drugs, and rock and roll and all of that. So needless to say, alcohol and cocaine were part of the job benefits. And I was kind of able to cultivate this relationship with alcohol and other substances that was directly tied to my work. And I felt that, you know, the opportunities and the FaceTime with people who made decisions came at the late night parties. And so I was, it worked out well for me too, because it was just like, okay, great. All I need to do is like party and, you know, that's how I'm seen. It was great. And it was fun for a long time. You know, having to wake up and write every day becomes very difficult when you're hungover. And to get through the hangovers, I wasn't really doing Adderall anymore because I knew it was a really bad thing for me because I lost my appetite. I just wanted to smoke cigarettes and party. So I would mostly just smoke pot to get through the hangovers and go to work. And then I would find myself getting lost in spreadsheets and like trying to make them perfect. And just even this extra layer of paranoia over the anxiety of drinking, it just made everything so difficult. At that point, the only dancing I was doing was drunk on a dance floor in Brooklyn somewhere. You know, I'd take my journal to the bar and, you know, just be one of those people at the bar trying to journal, but, you know, really just looking for trouble. And, you know, I'd wake up the next day and just have these like indecipherable scrawls. Yeah. It just became harder and harder to write. And I didn't want to do it. And it was a hurdle. And I eventually pivoted into doing physical production and producing and directing short documentaries. And, you know, and that worked because I didn't have to write, but that did mean that I had to travel a lot and was on weird time zones and in hotels. And of course that just sort of fueled my drinking habits and in airports. And I managed to handle it all, but there was a lot of close calls. I mean, sometimes I would oversleep. I always worked extra hard to make up for being hungover so that no one could really call me out. And then of course I started to do like little bits of Adderall that I would steal from my roommate a lot of the time. And I owe him an amends at some point. But yeah, the Adderall just started to add again, like another manic layer over like the confusion of alcohol or the confusion of pot, the anxiety of alcohol. And it really by that point, like nothing was working for me. None of the substances were working for me, but I also was completely reliant on them because I thought that in order to do what, you know, I thought was my biggest gift to the world, I guess. Like I thought I needed this stuff. It's also a thing where if I'm high off a substance, you know, if something I produce isn't great, I have something to blame as well. And it's very scary to think of putting myself out creatively without some sort of crutch or something to blame. And also at that point, I didn't really have the capacity to do things sober. I mean, everything I did, I started being high for. I would go to the museums by myself, stoned out of my mind, and get, you know, really creatively inspired. I would go to a yoga class. I would go to an occasional dance class, but I would always be stoned. And for a lot of that stuff too, it's doing physical activity when you're smoking, is difficult on the lungs. I wasn't really getting a benefit out of anything. It was just sort of like, okay, can I do these sort of normal, healthy things to balance out the substances? So I wouldn't sort of see them as problematic. But eventually I didn't think I could do anything creative, especially for my personal creativity and nurturing, like the journaling or the, the personal writing or, by that time I didn't want to pursue acting or singing at all. You know, the dance stuff, I didn't feel, I couldn't do that because I was just hungover on the weekends or trying to, go to bottomless brunches. And I also used to make collages out of, imagery and text and, occasional sort of like 3D mixed media. And it was something that I would kind of do for my friends when they had birthdays. I'd make them these like visual kind of cards. And that's something that always sort of brought me joy because it was another way for me to connect imagery and words and just make it into something pretty. And I had stopped doing that as well. I felt like if I wasn't going to do something perfectly, there was no point in doing it at all. And I became a shell of a person, and eventually it all came crashing down. And I landed myself, I was fired from a job. I was working freelance at that time. I had left that media company after 7 years, was working on a reality show in Florida, and got fired, which was the first time I'd ever gotten fired. I ended up in rehab, which I'm really grateful for. The best thing that's ever happened to me, really. But when I was in rehab, I still didn't think I had to stop smoking pot. I was like, okay, yeah, I know drinking is the problem, but the pot is just like, it's my antidepressant. It's my anxiety pill, if you will. And the doctors and the therapists there were like, okay, well, I think you should think about it. And eventually after about 30 days, this fog started to lift, and the sort of irritability of not being able to smoke weed sort of lifted. And I remember starting to read books, and I could remember what I read the day before. And I had never really done crossword puzzles, and I started doing crossword puzzles, and these words that I don't even think I had ever known started coming out of my mouth, and my vocabulary came back as I was talking to people and going to therapy and talking a lot as one does in rehab and in this program. It was so surprising. And that was kind of an early sign to me that like, this pot stuff doesn't really do much for me. And I got back on antidepressants and some other mood stabilizers, for my mental health stuff. I got out of rehab, and, I realized that a creative person is creative. And as long as you nurture it, as long as you're doing the things that make your individual happy and sing and feel like you're connected to, the muse, as I say. And I eventually went back to documentary film. I work at a documentary studio as a creative executive, and I get to do kind of everything I love to do, which is write and tell stories, and think of creative visual ways to portray them on screen. That's not just, your run-of-the-mill documentary with a bunch of talking heads and, some archival. So that's what I get to do. And it's the first time that in a long time that I've had to do sustained writing, and I feel like when I'm doing my exercise, when I'm, when I'm listening, taking time to listen to new music, when I'm going to the museums and taking care of myself, that's when I can get in the zone. And I think my best days are the ones where I lose track of time and my brain is just connecting things and I'm able to articulate and I'm getting inspired. And, you know, I think I'm able to kind of get in that zone more frequently and for longer periods of time now that I'm sober, which is something I never would I really ever thought. Like yesterday, for example, I woke up at 7:45 AM on a Saturday to make it to the West Side in Los Angeles for this dance class. And I went and, I got out of there at 10 AM, just serotonin, just on a huge high. And it just made my day so good. And that's something I never could have done when I was drinking or using, waking up that early on a Saturday and kind of putting my body through something really difficult. So anyway, I'm all like about trying to find ways to get high without getting high. And I think for me, different ways of creativity and kind of cultivating that, that creative muse just is the most magical thing in my life. And, you know, like I was saying at the beginning, to be creative, you don't have to be working in that area. You know, it can just be hobbies that bring you joy. And, I would encourage everyone, if you don't already, just find those things that bring you that joy and that pleasure. So, I think I will wrap it there. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kathleen. Thank you to Sri, to Megan, and to Kathleen. I certainly have just spent a lot of time fascinated and inspired. And I wanted to make sure that we had time for sharing because there's a lot that's gone on here. And I think people are going to have things that they connected with. And I'd like to hear from anyone who is inspired or has something to say. Jerome.
Hi, I'm Jerome. I'm an alcoholic. I'm an addict. Today is 30 months for me, which is cool. So I am inspired because this is just such a good topic. Do I lose my personality? Am I not as funny? Am I not as creative? Will I make good art if I get sober? That's the biggest question. Like, that's what this is about. And like, the shares are really, really, really good. Thank you. Kathleen mentioned it about Adderall. And drugs and alcohol for artists and creatives. This is all just my opinion from my experience. Drugs, just to use Kathleen's experience, Adderall got her there, man. Got locked in and it created stuff. It does. There is no doubt. Drugs, alcohol, the lifestyle, everything does cause some really killer art. Does. Gets you there, maybe. But if you look at any artist, just go on Google, have an exercise, look at any artist at all that is still relevant after 10, 15 years, like an actor, anybody, music. You'll find more people that had to find sobriety or in the process of finding sobriety or going back and forth. There's a point where you just got to make a decision if you're going to still doing what you do. It doesn't work anymore. But the fear is, like, I've had people tell me, like, God, Jerome, back in the day, like, dude, you're so much more fun when you drink. Yeah, because I'm fucking funny and I make people laugh and it's great. And that's what that was my comfort zone, right? But so the fear, that fear of, like, will I lose everything that I'm about if I don't do this? And then there's examples of people that just never stopped and it worked for them till the day they die. Lemmy's one of those people, right? I come from that, like, music world. Lemmy's one of those people. He drank Jack and Coke into his 70s and did speed and found out he was going to die about 2 weeks before he died, went to the Rainbow Room, hung out for a little bit, and just passed away politely. Like, he just did that. And that's the outlier. That's the alien out there. It doesn't work that way. But so can I be sober and still be creativity? Yes, but you have to, like, get – it's that thing that – I hate the expression dry drunk, but – until you just put in the work and actually, and I hate the psychic change thing and all these little phrases that people use so lazily, but you actually if you think you're missing, if you're an artist and you think you're missing out and you've convinced yourself that you're not as funny, like you think that, then that will be the case. If you think you're missing out on it, if you get to a place, and that's where I've got, that's why I mentioned 30 months. Like, I'm like, I literally go out and I'm around and I'm like, I don't, this is better. Like, it's not even like, you know, it's not amazing, but it's like, it actually is something like I heard recently, progressive sobriety. As it goes along, there's almost, there's nothing that would make it better to go back to where I was. Although I have no regrets of where I was. You don't lose your artistic side of you. It gets better, but first, it's almost like a bad relationship. You don't go and fall in love again, right? You have to take some time. You have to just work on yourself, all these cliches, right? And then go revisit it after you're completely, or you're more comfortable in just being like a practicing and pretending you're a normal person who just gets up in the morning, has a day, enjoys things, and then goes to sleep and never gets fucked up that day. Like, you have to actually get to that point. And then you revisit it and you're going to find, I think in my experience, you're going to find, you know, your ideas aren't as dumb the next day. You're funnier. You remember stuff like that, you know, like I think it's better. And then the other thing, back to Lemmy, was really, and I'm sorry, I'm going long, but back to Lemmy, he was interviewed in an article. This is the second aspect of it about being sober. He wrote an article, Lemmy, how did you do drugs all your whole life and do this? And you're just like all these other people in art, they die at 28 and they don't make it. And it's just like, you just for some reason have this longevity. You know, Lemmy's the singer bassist for Motorhead, right? And like, yeah, anyway, look it up. Like, but they go, what's the secret? What's your secret? And he goes, well, you know, the drugs and alcohol is a thing, but what really is artists, entertainers, they're so used to the noise. They're so used to the attention. There's always something going on that when it gets quiet, there's a syndrome where people come home from tour and everybody's handing them beers and it's great. They go home, they tell their wife, hey, can you get me a beer? And they go, get your own fucking beer. And they become a normal person, or they go back to their day job. Right. And it's like, they can't handle being in their own thoughts. So that's the other aspect of it, is you have to be okay. And Lemmy's just like, yeah, man, when I get done with tour, I go by myself into Montana. I could be by myself for months and I read about history and I do this. And like, so that's the other aspect of it. When you get sober and you're an artist, is you really have to learn to like the quiet and be in your own head, and meditation helps. Anyway, sorry, I went on long, but yeah, that's an inspiring topic for me.
Thank you. Marcia.
Hey, family. I'm an alcoholic and addict. My problem is Marcia. I don't have as many words as Jerome does. Well done, Jerome. I think listening to you. You're awesome. I just wanted to say thank you to all three of the people that were speaking, Shri and Kathleen and Megan. You know, it wasn't until I heard little bits and pieces from all of you that I realized, I always tell myself that I have no creative talents, but they're buried down in there. And each one of you touched on something that brought a memory up, and I'm very grateful for that. So I think it's time to start doing some different stuff, which is what, you know, friends and sponsors have been trying to get me to do for a couple of years now. Do something different. So, okay, fine. I think I will find something different to do. So, yeah, that really is all I wanted to say. And just to thank you, Megan, I look forward to getting to know you and talking from Jamaica as well. And there's a few things I want to ask you about, because my mom's like, she was listening as well. She said, find out if she knows this person and that person. I'm like, Mom, it's a meeting. Like, come on. But you know, right? You understand. Kathleen, it's always a pleasure. I see you at different meetings and stuff. As now, it's nice to get to know you just a little bit more and know you got like all that stuff going on. Like, that's just amazing. When I think, when anybody that can chew gum and walk is amazing to me. So, like, well done. Shri, I'm every time, yeah, same thing with you. I hear you. There's different things coming. I'm like, how sober is this? You talk like you got a million years of sobriety. I'm just like, what? And it's relevant stuff. It's relevant stuff. But it's the calmness of your voice that pisses me off. Okay. Hummingbird on Red Bull. Okay. You're just a little bit too calm for me. Okay. You got to come on. No, thank you all very much. Thanks to everybody being of service. Yeah. Keep your head out of your butt, family. Do the next right thing. Love y'all.
Thank you, Marcia. Janice.
My name's Janice. I'm an alcoholic. Oh, those are three great chairs.
I'm like Marcia. It sounds like you have so many years of sobriety and you are so calm. You've got a beautiful, beautiful voice to talk with. You know, it's you would have been great on radio. And Kathleen, I haven't seen you for a while, but there's a lot in there that I can identify with. And Megan, I'm glad I've heard you for the first time. And that's really all I have to say. It's been great. That's all.
D. Hi, everybody. I'm D. I am an alcoholic. Oh, thank you all so much. Three beautiful stories. And congratulations, Megan. Congratulations, everyone. And thank you all for coming to share. I love coming here and listening to the stories, and I really liked today. One thing that stuck out to me, and now I can't remember the exact words when Sheree said, now I don't have to be what, a desperate, crazy person in front of everyone. And I was thinking about the creativity or anything else in us, and I thought, yeah, you know, the alcohol and drugs, sometimes they can bring that out, and then they bring out other things. And then they bring on other things, and then they take it all away if you get to live that long, you know. So, you know, I don't know. Then we get to heal if we're lucky enough to find our way, thank goodness, and find out that it was inside of us all along. We just hadn't had a way to get to it. And this seems to be a place where we can all find our way. Glad to hear everybody, and thank you all very much.
And thank you, Dee. I want to thank Joe for all of his work on these monthly soirees, and Kenji, Megan, and Kim for co-hosting, taking care of the mechanics, and particularly Megan, Sheree, and Kathleen, who have been extremely gracious. And once again, Megan, happy 13th birthday. So much. So fabulous that you could celebrate that here with us. And we will stay as long as anybody else wants to have anything to say. But I just want to thank you all for being here and thank our host, co-host, and our speakers for being of service, because that's what makes all this work.
In fact, if everyone wants to unmute and offer a audible thank you, by all means.
Thought you were going to get them to sing again, Joe. Like,
no, not here. Okay. Not now. Thanks, everybody. That was wonderful. Me, Kathleen, Megan, Deborah for putting it all together. Yeah. And everyone behind the scenes who helped.
Three, fashionably miserable.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I've indulged there a little bit. I listen to Radiohead very differently now. It was a soundtrack of my high school years. You know, I listen to them very differently. But thanks so much for everyone. Super. Thanks for being here. Thanks for all your shares. I do want to share something in the chat that I heard in a meeting. This was used to apparently be in Chris Farley's wallet. It really spoke to me. It's called the Clown's Prayer. And I saw this in a meeting, and I just love it.
Do you read it?
Want to read it? Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard to scroll down.
Sure. It says the clown's prayer, you know, E.T.'s prayer for me. And as I stumble through this life, help me create more laughter than tears. Dispense more happiness than gloom. Spread more cheer than despair. Never let me become so indifferent that I will fail to see the wonders in the eyes of a child or the twinkle in the eyes of the aged. Never let me forget that my total effort is to cheer people, make them happy, and forget momentarily all the unpleasantness in their lives. And in my final moment, may I hear you whisper, when you made my people smile, you made me smile.
Fantastic.
Thanks.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.